I wanted to start by asking you, what are your top three tips for managers for motivating their employees?
Well, I'd start out by saying that basically motivation is about good management. And in some ways, I think that federal managers are going to be disappointed in my answer because your core leadership and management skills are basically the most important thing in keeping employees motivated. So setting expectations and goals, communicating regularly with employees, and then holding them accountable for the results based on the expectations you've set up. So that's number one. Number two, I think set the example. As you mentioned, these are tough times for folks with the budgets and demands, and in some ways our political system kind of attacking federal government employees. It's hard for the boss to stay motivated. And when a boss is down, that really does affect the team. So the boss has to look themselves in the mirror every morning and have something that keeps them motivated, keeps them engaged, and sets the example for everyone else. And then kind of the last thing is on our to-do list, we have to somehow fit appreciation in. Federal employees, and basically anybody, is motivated more by day-to-day sense of appreciation than large, big overtures. You know, our annual performance awards are going down, and we worry that we don't have those kinds of tools to recognize folks when really keeping them engaged and motivated is about doing little things every day, every week, whether it's a thank you email, a handwritten thank you note, an attaboy or a props, something that says the boss cares about the employee and recognizes when the employee's done a great job.
Do you think that federal managers or just managers in general sometimes underestimate the power that those kinds of things can have?
Yeah, I think we do. We get so focused on big events. You know, I'm going to have a performance management meeting or I'm going to do an annual evaluation. And so many times it's the small little things. It's that hallway interaction where you smile and you appreciate someone rather than being hurried because you're late to your next meeting. It's sort of being in the moment. If we think about our personal relationships, we celebrate anniversaries once a year, but we all know that we need to hear I love you a lot more frequently than that. To succeed in a relationship, the same is true with employees.
Do you think that an in-person thank you, a face-to-face, you know, just turning around at your desk and saying to the person beside you, you know, thank you, or a manager walking over to an employee's desk and saying, thank you for that, that was amazing, you know, where other people can now see that this is happening, this interaction is occurring, is a better method than, say, public praise in an email? You know, I know that, you know, we've used that here in our office where, you know, we'll send out an email to the entire staff praising someone for something they've done because it's a quick way to get everyone involved and to make sure that everyone sees that praise that we're giving. What would you say is the better method, you know, in person where maybe a smaller group sees the public praise, or an email where the praise may be forwarded to more people?
I think it probably takes both, but I would say if a manager or a leader or a supervisor is having regular staff meetings, that's an excellent place to make recognition for individual accomplishments, something that happens on a regular basis at a staff meeting. Bosses need to remember that not only are you praising that person, but you're actually putting your unit's goals and missions and essentially putting them on display by what you're thanking or appreciating, so that it's as much about everyone else hearing these are the kinds of things that we should keep doing as it is additionally for the person who gets the praise in person. I think feedback through email is also useful, although I would say that that's more about communicating directly to the person you're thanking, mm-hmm. as opposed to sending a broad mass email out recognizing someone or thanking them. I think it's just as important to send a direct email to that person, and it does create a record that you could print as a boss, stick it in an employee's folder, and when it comes time to nominate them for a formal award, evaluate them, you've got a record through that email of something they did that you thought was noteworthy. And in that case, the email needs to be specific enough. You know, you did a great job today. isn't going to help us when it comes time to write an award or doing an evaluation. You did a great job at doing this particular project. Here's what you did that was above and beyond, and here's why it mattered so much to our unit and to our mission.
What motivational tools have you seen managers use that maybe don't work? You know, people might think that they do, but when it comes down to it, it really isn't as effective as maybe some other tools.
I think assuming that one size fits all can really have a boss fall on their face for two reasons. One, every boss is different. And so while some boss may be able to do something very silly and get away with it and everybody appreciates it and uses humor to recognize folks, another boss, if they try to do that same thing, may fall flat on their face because they're not comfortable with that particular style. So the boss has to pick a style that they're comfortable with that makes sense to them, because then they'll do it. When we choose things that we don't, you know, buy deep inside, then we're reluctant to do them. So in that sense, each boss is different, and there's going to be different techniques. And then the second thing is each employee is different. You do have people that don't want public recognition, that truly, truly don't want them. We also have people who have some sense of false modesty, and they say they don't want public recognition, but they secretly sort of do. The boss has got to take some time to get to know each person and figure that out. Because publicly praising someone who is painfully shy, and that actually could be a demotivation. So you've got to know your employee, you've got to know yourself, and you've got to come up with strategies that make sense, taking both of those personalities into account.
You've had an extensive career in the federal government and specifically in the Air Force as well. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what federal managers can learn from the military about keeping their employees motivated. One of the things I see over and over again is that, you know, overall, the military tends to be a very, very motivated workforce. So what can people learn from that?
There are a number of things to learn, and my Air Force career actually started at the U.S. Air Force Academy. So I had 4 years of undergraduate education that involved discussions of leadership. And I think probably the biggest thing that the military does on a regular basis is it's really leadership-centric. There's a formal leadership training program at all levels, whether it's for young officers or young enlisted folks. There's a planned path to leadership. There's different types of courses at each stage. And so leadership is always sort of on the hearts and minds of military folks. It's a regular topic of discussion. As an officer, there were often professional reading lists, and they would be out there, and there would be an expectation that you were going to, on your own, be reading to further yourself, both in your leadership skills and in the profession that you were in. I don't see as much discussion in my experience with federal agencies on leadership. We tend to get more bogged down with, we owe this report to Congress on this date. Have we met all of our deadlines? What's due next? When do we have our next budget submission? And we don't stop to add leadership as a topic in staff meetings or things like that. The second thing, I think the military has a natural sort of unit identity, whether it's flags, insignia, ceremonial things that a lot of federal agencies don't have. Some of them do have annual events that are very memorable that become part of the culture, but I would say that the military has a stronger sense of unit identity, you know, from the smallest sort of group of folks all the way up that maybe we don't take as serious in the federal government. And then the last thing, I think we do a better job in the military of knowing who's in charge at a particular time. By law, a commander has certain responsibilities, and a command can't be left vacant. And there are formal change of command ceremonies. And even though military leadership turns over maybe more frequently than in the civilian sector, there's always a clear path. We know who's in charge. And sometimes, particularly when we're dealing with budget issues and restructuring and advertising positions, we will leave a management position on the civil service side vacant without a clear sort of direction of, you know, who is the acting, who's handing this. So I think that creates some stability in military leadership, even though it changes more, the lines are clear. And then I mentioned last, but now thinking about it, probably one more thing. In the military, we have high expectations. You know, when a Marine unit goes to do something, they know it's going to be hard. It's advertised to be hard from the beginning. The expectation is it's going to be hard. But there's this we can do it attitude. And I think sometimes we actually lower expectations, afraid on the civilian sector side, afraid to push people too much, and that we underestimate their ability to stretch and reach a high goal or a high accomplishment.
What are some of the side effects then of an unmotivated workforce that, you know, managers should be on the lookout for? I'm thinking, you know, if you've got one employee within your unit that perhaps is unmotivated, can that be dangerous? Can that be a slippery slope to all of a sudden more people becoming unmotivated? And how can managers get everyone back on board and get those motivation levels back up?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that motivation is contagious and demotivation is equally or maybe more seriously contagious, in that a boss does have to address someone's motivation. I think a couple things can happen there. Direct dialogue with an employee who is not motivated. We've become sort of a society that isn't always interested in conversations that involve a level of conflict. And having to say to someone, look, you don't appear to be motivated, or the attitude you displayed in our staff meeting last week was really negative, and that's dragging the group down. We're not always comfortable with that conversation, and I think we have to have it probably more than we realize. With things like motivation and attitude, there isn't really a book you can go to say, well, someone has a bad attitude, that's actionable, we need to do something. It's more about the boss recognizing it, having a continuous dialogue, and being able to tell someone, it's not okay for you to be so negative in a staff meeting. I want you to be positive. And then talk to folks about there's a time and a place for sort of airing concerns and negative attitudes, but it isn't every time and every place. The other thing I think with our challenges now, that bosses have to balance themselves, how much are they going to acknowledge these are tough times, you're being asked to do something that, you know, I wish I could have pushed back on this deadline, I wish I could have gotten you more resources, I wish I could hire a replacement for the person we lost last week, but I can't. And so a boss really has to balance the open acknowledgement that there is a struggle and it is tough with staying motivated themselves and leading by continuing to somehow, you know, reach down and still have a good attitude. But I think acknowledging that there is a struggle and not just being positive to a fault can have value when people see that you are fighting for them. They do realize that you recognize that what you're asking them to do is difficult.
You were a Fed for many years, and I'm wondering, you know, when you see these stories about a two-year pay freeze and tighter federal budgets and federal employees being asked to do, you know, the same amount of work with less money, in some cases, you've been there. What kind of effect have you seen that have on federal employees?
I mean, it does have an effect. Right now, sometimes I think the phrase the government has become sort of a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't even really know what it means anymore. Or it's so big that we're not clear. And when we hear the media or people talking about the government as the problem, I like to break that down. Are we talking about elected officials? Are we talking about full-time federal government employees? Are we talking about political appointees? Are we talking about the executive branch or Congress or whoever? So I think trying to be more specific and putting a face on who federal employees are and what they do for our country is really, really important. It's been interesting, although I was in three major federal agencies in my career, since I've left and I've begun doing this executive training, I've learned so much more about what our government does for our country and for our citizens than I ever realized. And I think sometimes our public doesn't always appreciate how much we do, and it's important to try to get those stories out and work with the media as we have this difficult thing. So that's kind of an external putting a more of a face on who a federal employee is, what a federal agency does. The other thing, and it's kind of changing topics a little bit, but a supervisor in a tight budget time can't afford to carry someone who isn't meeting their expectations.
Hmm.
And that sometimes when we think about money and not getting a 2% raise, there are a number of studies out there that say money isn't exactly the number one motivator as much as we think it is. There was a Gallup study that said kind of the magic number salary-wise for happiness was $75,000. That's not going to play in every part of the country, and maybe $75,000 isn't the right number in New York City or Washington, D.C. But the point of the study was that once people have their overall basic needs met, money isn't necessarily their number one motivator. And so I don't think we should be so worried about that budget, although, we want the budget increase, we want the salary increase. But dealing with the poor performers so that your best performers aren't carrying extra load is one of the biggest ways of keeping your best performers fully engaged and motivated, because if you don't, they're going to choose either to leave this organization and go somewhere else, or to say, you know what, my colleague doesn't have to do all this extra work. I'm not going to either. And that's where you have the contagion of someone demotivated. Hopefully, and I haven't seen yet that we've had any hard freezes. Some agencies are using them. But I become very concerned when a hiring freeze is used in such a way that a supervisor will choose not to address an employee with a serious performance problem, because their fear is if they actually took an action, for example, to demote or remove that their employee, that they would lose that what we call FTE, the funding for that particular position. So I hope in any agency where they're using freezes, or if Congress ever does that, that they create some sort of exception that if a supervisor involuntarily demotes or removes someone, that the freeze, if you will, doesn't apply to that position that's vacated. And that way we can continue to ensure that we've got the right people on board, because, carrying someone when you're already doing more than your group can be really have really negative consequences in this current budget structure.
Speaking about Congress there, do you think that Congress realizes how, continuing resolution after continuing resolution or tighter budgets or a pay freeze in some cases might affect the federal workforce? Do they understand how their decisions directly impact, the federal workforce, and then that could impact the output, which inevitably goes back to their constituents? Do they understand that domino effect?
From watching what's happened over the last year, no, it's not clear that they understand. I'm sure some of our elected officials do, based on their experience and get into it, so I don't want to paint too broad of a brush, but there was a couple of weeks where I was actually with agencies doing training as, the continuing resolution was getting ready to expire, and the number of hours of lost productivity preparing for this event that ultimately didn't happen, and any one of those given times, there was a direct sort of loss of productivity and drain on the system when that happens. We've talked a lot, in our politics about the need for companies to have stability and predictability in planning. Well, federal agencies are no different. And that kind of predictability on budgets, on annual budgets, helps people make good, strong management and mission-related decisions with money. There may not be a profit motive for the government, but there's still, it's just as important to plan, or even more so, and that having a little more stability in our federal budgets, I think, will make a huge difference in what we can and can't accomplish. And so, yeah, I think that there's sometimes there isn't that same face of the federal employee or face of a work unit and how these budget fights have affected us.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, what do you think federal managers can do in this climate to keep recruitment numbers up and encourage people that the federal government is still a great place to work? I know earlier, you know, you talked a little bit how people don't necessarily realize the difference between Joe Blow, federal employee working at, you know, the Department of Homeland Security and a member of Congress. And so if they're kind of lumping everybody together and the overall, you know, approval rate of everybody is low, that may discourage people from applying perhaps for a federal job. So what can managers do to stop that from happening?
Well, I think the first thing that you can do is focus on the mission and how important what everybody does, whether you're, as you mentioned, in the Department of Homeland Security, working on IT security or working on border security or working on aviation security. There's a connection to the mission that's so important. And people are motivated by making the world a better place. And in the federal government, there's so many different ways people can do that. And then the boss has to connect that mission to each job. So whether someone's a starting out administrative specialist working mostly on paperwork and time and attendance, they still need to be connected to whatever their unit or their branch or their agency's mission is. So try to connect people to the mission. The good thing is, as the entire economy has sort of faltered, I think the federal government with our benefits has stayed very competitive. So I think we're still able to recruit and get people in and, you know, acknowledging that we do have some pretty significant and important benefits, assuming those aren't changed in all of these budget fights, is another recruitment tool. But what I think we have to be even more conscious of is what can we do to keep the good folks once they come into the government from then choosing to leave. And that's where I think all of these motivational techniques matter, because if the best employees see opportunity in the private sector that they think is going to be more lucrative, sometimes they will go. So keeping them engaged and focused on the missions. We do have to modernize our attitudes about the workplace a little bit. What comes to mind right off the top, and I know you've done some writing on it, is telework.
Mm-hmm.
And bosses who come from an era where telework wasn't even conceivable have to make sure that they can embrace some of these modern ways that people function and do this. I was talking with one supervisor who told me, well, I'll only let the people in my unit telework on Wednesdays. And I thought that was a very odd comment. And I asked why. And the answer turned out to be, in this particular geographical location, lots of people would head to the beach for the weekends. And this supervisor kind of said, well, if they telework on Thursday or Friday or Monday or Tuesday, they're really probably just extending their long weekend at the beach and they're not going to be productive, whereas I know no one's at the beach on Wednesdays. And I thought that that was such a negative comment about trust,
mm-hmm.
and that trust between the supervisor and the subordinate is so important, and that the flexibility that we can give people doesn't mean that you don't trust them. You've got to be able to approach those modern tools, use them. Lots of studies show that offering telework, offering a flexible start time so people can get home to see a child's soccer game or something, you know, like that, deal with other life obligations, we're going to have to be modern in that. The folks coming into the workplace now have lots of life balance expectations. They watch their parents maybe not lead a balanced life, and so that we're going to have to modernize our ideas and attitudes and make sure that we welcome everybody in to the workplace.
Anything else you wanted to add before we wrap up?
Just, I have been so incredibly fortunate to work for the federal government, both on active duty in the civil service and now working with the federal government. It's amazing to me how much good federal employees do on a day-in and day-out basis for our country and I appreciate them, and I hope that everyone can, you know, stop and take a moment and realize how important what the federal government does is.